Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 31st of August, 2022, and this is Reconstruction, last of the summer podcasts with Foggy Taylor and Compo Bishop. Actually, I think that's only the meteorologist, who think that summer ends on the 31st of August. We've had this conversation before, I won't go over it again. Anyway, for some people it's the end of summer, but for others it goes on until the end of September, so there we are.
We did the weather last time, didn't we?
We are British, after all, it's bound to crop up.
Let's talk money, David. Let's talk money. Let's talk business.
Let's talk money. Yeah, why not? Well, yes, of course, and the topic for today's discussion, and there is only really one topic, I'm sure that we'll touch on other things as they crop up, is the annual Construction Index Top 100, which is due out in the magazine next week or shortly afterwards. It's gone to press already, so it's being printed as we speak.
Do we know when it's going to appear online, David? I should know these things. We normally give the magazine. We normally give the magazine readers first dibs on the good stuff, and it goes online a couple of weeks after. But within the next 2 or 3 weeks, I would imagine you can probably
It should be online.
Expect to find all the numbers that we've been crunching. I say you've been doing all the work on this one.
Well, I can't even take the credit for this because, in fact, as in previous years, our top 100, all the number crunching has been done by one of our freelance contributors, Steve Mennery, who is a numbers person, old colleague of mine from Construction News many years ago. He's run the rule over the top 100.
As we know in life, it's always the subcontractors that do the real hard work.
That's right. Yeah, that's very true. That is very true. I simply edited it. And
I bet you haven't paid him yet.
I got his invoice in yesterday.
So in about 60 days, he'll dust it off.
Yeah, he'll be paid. He'll be paid. Anyway. Yeah, so this is our annual exercise in trying to make sense of how business is going for the 100 largest main contractors. And as always, I suppose we ought to include the caveat that this isn't a precise science. This isn't an exact science. We select these companies. We try to select the ones which we think, first of all, qualify as main contractors. And there are some businesses in there which some people might say, well, they're not contractors. I mean, Otis, for example, the lift people. You can't go into a high-rise building without, obviously you can because other people make lifts, but Otis is one of the leading ones. And it's a very big supplier. And so it qualifies. And there are others like HomeServe.
I saw HomeServe. That's an oddity. And we've got rid of, we've got rid of Mighty used to be in
that's
here.
That's right. Yeah, some
often.
Time ago, yeah.
And we decided that while they did change a few light bulbs and do a bit of building maintenance, we didn't really qualify them. We've got HomeServe in this time. I think it's all based on their, what's the jargon for the business, SIC code, is it?
That's right, categorises
them as a business.
Yeah.
And I think it depends on the SIC code that these companies define themselves by as to how they get in.
Yeah, they self-identify, don't they, as construction firms. And so we have to take
as is
them,
the modern way.
As is, indeed. Obviously, you have to find some mechanism of filtering out your selection. And, of course, the SIC code, which is the way companies are categorised at Companies House, is the obvious way of doing that.
HomeServe, for those who don't know, it's sort of an AA or an RAC for homeowner. Or
that's right, yeah.
Home, not just homeowners. I think people in the
residents, households. I would
householders.
Say.
That's the word.
Yeah. I mean, I get regular missives from them, actually, reminding me that I'm responsible for the water pipe between my meter and my house. And I ought to take out some sort of insurance to make sure that I'm not liable for massive leaks which occur. They remind me of this regularly, every year, at least once. So that's my personal experience with HomeServe. But I think they do, you know, proper building maintenance as well, small works, probably, I imagine.
Do they do it in the commercial sector, or is it all domestic residences?
No, I think it's all domestic. I mean, I assume that they might have some arrangement with housing associations and maybe some local authorities. I don't honestly know. But their business really is building maintenance and services for domestic householders. So, yeah, you might say that, you know, they're not a Balfour Beatty or a Kier, but they consider themselves to be a construction firm.
And who
am I to say otherwise?
And the one with the biggest profits, £175 million pound profit in their latest year to March 22 is their latest accounts.
That's right, yes.
And their 12th biggest construction company by our definitions.
By turnover, yeah.
With a turnover of, where are we, 1.43 billion.
Yeah.
1429 million. So, yeah, a big outfit, but I'm not entirely. And we've talked before about the anomalies in this. I mean, we've got, for example, we merrily include Balfour Beatty's US and Hong Kong revenues. But when it comes to, you know, Skanska and BAM and so on, we only count their UK business, not their international business. So, there's an argument that says maybe we should strip out Balfour Beatty's foreign earnings, but it all comes back to the UK, I think. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
There's many ways we could slice the cake, but yeah, we've got all of Balfour Beatty's revenue in there, but the foreign firms have only got their UK revenues.
Yeah. And I think when you're reading this and looking through the figures, you have to bear that in mind, that there are characteristics of each company that can throw up anomalies, and you're not necessarily comparing like with like, but it's a broad brush, and I think it does give a useful snapshot of what the trends are in the sector. And the trends are quite interesting this year, because, you know, we're facing in this country, we're facing crises from all sides, aren't we? I mean, we've got obviously the Brexit one, which people have been bellyaching about for the last 6 years.
Is that a crisis?
6 years.
Is Brexit a crisis?
Well, I think for some people it is. If you read through the...
But none of our contractors are working. No, I mean, Balfour Beatty don't work in France, and Kier don't work in Portugal, and you know.
No, that's true. But I think the thing is that a lot of people... They will see, for example, that they have difficulty getting skilled labour or any labour, and there's a tendency for people to say, "Well, this is because of Brexit. We don't have the Eastern European workers coming over and working here."
Yes, they do. They've still got them.
Well, they do, and you're absolutely right. I mean, in fact, it has been shown recently that, in fact, I think there's been a slight increase in the number of European, well, no, not European, but overseas workers coming in. A large increase. I can't remember where I saw the figures, and I can't remember what the figures are, but I did read somewhere very recently, I think it might have been in the right-wing press, I think it might have been The Spectator, actually, that the number of immigrant workers in this country has actually increased since, you know, we signed the Brexit agreement. Most of the increase has come from outside of the EU. So Southeast Asia, the Indian subcontinent and places like that.
I think it's time. I mean, while it is too early really to know what the economic impact of Brexit has been or will be, I don't think it doesn't wash with me if construction companies to blame Brexit on their deterioration in profitability or whatever. There have been issues with the movement of goods. But if you remember, initially there was this problem with a big container ship getting stuck in the Suez Canal and everything. You know, there was no patio furniture in B&Q for 6 months or whatever. And then we've had bigger than that. And the bigger thing rather than Brexit has been we're still suffering from the economy as a whole, the hangover from the COVID-19 pandemic and variants thereafter, because there have been factories that have, around the world have been shut down and supply chains have been disrupted. Supply of materials, it's got a lot better, but there are certain things, I mean, nothing to do with construction, but notably, you know, all the microchips and the car manufacturing. Apparently, reading yesterday, you've got to wait a year or something if you want to buy a new car in many cases.
Really?
So it's not just construction. There is still a COVID hangover in the economy. I buy that, but Brexit, not sure.
No. I think you're quite right about COVID. And I also think that perhaps the full impact of COVID has been masked in a way that we haven't... When you think about it, it was an overused word at the time, but it's true. It's unprecedented what happened in 2020 and going into 2021 with the lockdowns and businesses just stopping, you know, full stop. It's never happened before like that. And of course, the government took action to try and soften the blow and keep things ticking over, and that I think probably made some people feel a false sense of security, because I mean you could furlough your staff, you could claim the support from the coronavirus business interruption loan scheme. But of course, those are loans, and with a loan, you've got to pay it back. This is one of the things that comes out in Steve Menery's discussion of the figures here, is that, you know, these loans were made to businesses to keep them afloat, and did keep them afloat, but those loans started to become due in March this year. And apparently, it seems that the construction sector, the level of defaults, the rate of default, is considerably higher than it is in other sectors. Steve mentions, I think the rate of default here is, the default rate for construction is 2.5%, which is more than twice that of other sectors such as arts and entertainment at 1.3%, and healthcare at 0.8%. So there is a problem there, which I think we haven't felt the full impact of yet, and I think we are going to find that. It's very interesting. Also, there's another section in here that looks at insolvencies, and insolvencies have actually increased. Let me see if I can just find it. Bear with me a second. The graphs here are very, quite impressive, actually. Company insolvencies in the construction industry, they dipped massively in 2020. You know, they were down.
That's because they were propped up. You didn't need to.
Yeah,
you didn't need to
fold
in 2020. You just carried on with government support.
If you look at the graph in 2019, the beginning of 2019, there were, I don't know, about 850 insolvencies in the construction sector. That fell to quarter three of 2020 to less than 450. But by quarter one 2022, they were up to over 1,000. So, you know, there's a problem there. Another thing about the insolvencies is that it seems to be the smaller specialist subcontractors who are most vulnerable at the moment. I think more than half of the construction sector insolvencies this year have been specialist subcontractors, mainly at the smaller end. So they're more vulnerable. And I think the reason for this is that because they are specialists, they don't have such a broad range of, you know, they don't have too many strings to their bow. Whereas, you know, the major contractors, the tier one contractors and the larger specialists have a broader range. They've got a bit of a safety net there. So I think that's an interesting trend, and one that, you know, we ought to keep an eye on. I mean, we do our regular sector focus, don't we, in the magazine every month, but we're bi-monthly at the moment still. But we do look at a specialist sector of the industry every issue of the magazine. And I think that probably that trend will be very noticeable when going forward from now on, we'll see that problem of insolvencies increase.
Let's return to the top 100 and tell us, David. I mean, I think we mentioned that Balfour Beatty is number one, and that's no surprise. But talk us through the top 10. Who's up? Who's down? Who's gone?
Right. Okay. Then. Balfour Beatty's latest turnover, and that was for the year to the end of December, 2021. That was about 8.3 billion was their turnover, slightly down, about 4% down on the previous year, which was 8.6 billion, I think. They made a pre-tax profit of 87 million in 2021, which is a lot better than they did last year. They made a profit of 48 billion the previous year.
Million.
Sorry, million, yeah. 48 million in 2020. I mean, they're profit margins are very slim, you know, throughout the industry, throughout the sector. And Balfour Beatty's latest profit margin is 1.1%, which is wafer thin. Other people have lower profit margins. Kia, for example, which is number two, a profit margin of 0.2%. Kia have been making losses for years. They seem to be, the perennial loss maker, but actually they were in the black. This year, they turned over 3.3 billion, and that was in the year to June 2021. And that compared to a turnover of 3.5 billion in 2020, but they made a pre-tax profit of 5.6 million in 2021. And that was much better than before, because the previous year they lost 225 million. So they're back in the black, which is a good thing.
You say they lost 225 million the previous year. The year before that they lost 230 million.
Yes.
They've lost, and actually, if we go back, the year before that, no, they made a profit. It's only two. They lost about half a billion quid over 2 years.
Yeah, but they're back in the black just. So hopefully that will continue. Number three is Morgan Stindall. There's a big gap, as you can see, between Balfour Beatty's turnover.
But if you strip out Balfour Beatty's North American and Hong Kong operations, I'm not sure they'd even be any bigger than Kia and Morgan Sindel. I mean, Kia and Morgan Sindel are pretty much neck and neck. Kia's slightly bigger.
Yes, they are. Yeah, yeah.
But in terms of UK, I think Balfour Beatty is about the same sort of size off the top of my head.
You're probably right. In fact, maybe we ought to, as an exercise, try and do that. It's not very easy sometimes when... It depends how different companies actually report their figures. I mean, Lang O'Rourke, for example, doesn't break anything down. So it's very difficult to actually find out, you know, how much they're making in a different market, overseas market. Balfour Beatty, I'm not sure whether we can break their figures down. We probably could if we dug deep enough. Maybe we should do that sometime. But yeah, I agree with you that they are our biggest contractor, but we're taking into account their overseas turnover as well. Morgan Stindall, actually, his turnover was up about 6% on the previous year. Their financial year is also to the end of December 21.
Morgan Stindall is consistently our most profitable major construction company. It's clearly very well run.
It's actually the second most profitable this year.
Only to HomeServe, which is a different beast.
Only after HomeServe. Yeah, all right, we'll ignore HomeServe for the time being. Yeah, they are, yes. So 126.2 million pre-tax profit in 2021. The year before that, they made a pre-tax profit of 60.8 million.
3.9% margin.
Yeah, which is good.
It is huge.
Yeah, not as huge as HomeServe again.
No,
HomeServe
well, actually,
margin 12.3.
Looking through the margin column, there are a couple of other standout performers.
Yeah,
Bowman Kirkland, 5.5% margin. Skanska UK, 5.8% margin. And Murphy, 4.8. So some people, although the pre-tax profit margin is perhaps less, there are things that get thrown into pre-tax profit. I mean, that is the most important thing, the bottom line. That's the money that you're left with before you pay the tax man. And people talk about the importance of EBITDA and operating profit as a metric. Mm. And it is an important metric as an indication to shareholders to what's happening. So in many ways, the operating margin is perhaps more indicative of the success of the pure contracting side of the business. But we haven't done that number.
No, we haven't done. No,
we've got the pre-tax margin.
Yeah, exactly. And the, actually, the biggest pre-tax profit in terms of margin is Henry Boot. They made they turned over 231 million in 2021, and they made a profit of 35.1 million on that. That's a margin of 15.2%. So, you know, that's way ahead of anybody else, even HomeServe. And there are others as well.
I suspect a lot of that is from, I mean, Henry Boots, they're not just a builder. They what's the word for people who buy land, put it through planning permission, maybe do a bit of remediation. So it's land speculation, frankly, that they have a lot of success in as well.
I suppose they're more akin to a house builder in that respect, because, you know, land is where the money is after all, isn't it? And it owns its own money. But let me see. So I carry on going through the top 10. After Morgan Sindall, it's Amy. But they're a big loss maker. I mean, in fact, they're number 99 in terms of profitability amongst the top 100. Amy turned over 2.4 billion in the year to, this is the year to December 2020. So that was a difficult year, of course. And that was down 5.5% on the previous year, 2019. They actually made a loss of 98 million, which followed a loss the previous year of 109 million. So that's not so good. ISG.
Amy have been up for sale for ages as well, of course. Yeah. Ferrovial is the Spanish parent company, I believe. Yeah. They've been trying to offload them. It's going to be pretty hard to get a decent price for them if it's losing 100 million pounds a year consistently.
Yeah, yes, precisely. So it's a tricky one. ISG, on the other hand, don't appear to be doing too badly. I mean, they're not making a massive margin, even less than Balfour Beatty. It's a 0.8% margin. But they turned over in December in the year to December 21, 2.3 billion, up slightly, up almost 11% actually on the previous year. And they made a pre-tax profit of 18.5 million, which isn't bad. And then Keller, of course, is a subcontractor, a very big subcontractor. They're actually number six on our list of the top 100. But obviously, again, a piling specialist.
They work worldwide, and they wouldn't even figure on in our top 100 if you just looked at their UK operations.
No, absolutely not. No, but again, a healthy looking company. They turned over 2.2 billion last year. Up slightly on the year before, they made a profit of 72 million. Their profit margin is 3.2%, which is respectable, about average actually for the sector. And below them, at number seven, it's Tarmac Trading. The Tarmac, of course, used to be a very big tier one contractor back in the sort of 80s, 90s. You know, they were always referred to in the national press as Margaret Thatcher's favourite road builder. But of course, they got out of that and they went into materials.
Tarmac swapped, did a swap with Wimpy. And
that's right.
Tarmac's house building operation, which is quite a big thing, went to Wimpy, and Wimpy's construction operations went to Tarmac. And they changed their name to Carillion.
Carillion, that's right.
But who, the late lamented Carillion, or certainly the late Carillion, but there was a bit, the Tarmac building materials business was hived off either before or after that merge, I can't remember. And that's now part of CRH.
Yeah.
Now, what I don't know is whether, and I'm trying to think who the, there are contracting businesses that CRH owns. And I'm thinking, Farrans, is that a CRH company?
Yes, I think it is.
And I think there might be one or two others. Now, I don't know whether Farrans comes under Tarmac Trading or whether it's separate alongside Tarmac Trading. I'm not quite sure what Tarmac Trading is included in here. I mean, it does have a contracting business, but there's also a big materials business in Tarmac Trading there.
Well, they started to sort of re-emerge, I suppose, only a couple of years ago. I think it was 2 years ago, it might have been 3 years ago, that they that Tarmac appeared once more in the top 100, you know, as a contractor again, building roads. I mean, you know, it's in the name really, isn't it? But they've steadily risen up the rankings in the top 100. They're now at number seven, as I said. I don't know, without checking, whether or not that Tarmac trading does include Farrans or any of the other contracting groups, whether they've just come together and rebadged themselves or whether they've actually developed their own contracting business internally. I don't know about that.
Well, I've just had a look at their website while you were talking, and it doesn't appear to. It doesn't. What it says here is, which I didn't know this, Tarmac Contracting operates the largest highway maintenance and road surfacing business in the UK.
Hmm.
Constructing and surfacing over 5,000 miles of road every year and maintaining over... Okay, it's interesting. They construct and surface over 5,000 miles of road every year and maintain over 22,000 kilometres, which is about 15,000 miles, isn't it, roughly speaking? But why does they switch from miles to kilometres in the same sentence?
Yes, that's odd.
But anyway, they're a big road maintenance operation, so that yeah, they're not just a materials company at all.
No. Worth taking a closer look at them, actually.
Oh, hang on, here we go. They've got Riney and Griffiths are included in...
Okay, right.
In Tarmac
Trading. Griffiths.
Alan Griffiths, which is quite a big outfit.
Well, yeah, they're working just down the road from me at the moment, actually. I didn't realise that. That's interesting. Okay. But unfortunately, they're not making much of a profit. In fact, they're the biggest loss maker. They're number 100 in terms of profitability. They made a loss in the year to the year to December 2020, they made a loss of nearly 130 million on a turnover.
What's noticeable in our list this year is that it's a mixture of companies, because it all depends on whose results were available at time of putting it together,
sure,
which was mid-August or early August, I think. So Balfour Beatty, for example, we've got calendar year 2021 numbers. Whereas people like Amy, Tarmac Trading, Mace and others, it's calendar year 2020 are the latest results that we've got. And those companies whose numbers are for calendar year 2020 are disproportionately worse than those companies whose numbers are for calendar year 2021, which is not surprising, of course, because it was the calendar year 2020, which included the first national lockdown and the slow ramping back up of work. The worst of the COVID impact on business was in 2020. So, a slight caveat next to any companies whose numbers are from December 2020 is that, well, they would be worse, wouldn't they?
Well, yes, after Tarmac, at number eight is Mace, who share the same financial year. And again, their turnover, actually, Mace didn't do too badly. Their turnover was down about 3%. They turned over 1.7 billion in 2020. They actually made a pre-tax profit of nearly 32 million, which
is
about
the same. About the same as the year before. Well,
yeah, exactly. So they
had a good pandemic.
Pretty well. Yeah, they did. And in fact, yeah, very consistent, because their latest margin is 1.8% and the previous year it was 1.9%. So they didn't do too badly. But again, below them at number nine is Waits, and they're a 2021 year. So their turnover did increase by 12% to 1.6 billion.
Just another comment on Mace, if I may. What's interesting about that is, when we've talked before about who rode out the impact of the pandemic better and who suffered more, we've tended to think of, not to think, the facts have borne it out, on the whole, the companies that suffered less were sort of the civil engineering contractors who were maybe working in a sewage treatment works in the middle of nowhere, or building a road or flattening land in the middle of nowhere. So they could, you know, people sitting in their diggers and steamrollers on their own could carry on working quite happily. And the people who suffered the most, either the house builders or they were urban, particularly in the capital, people in the commercial sector building big buildings in London, where the workers couldn't get to work because, well, public transport wasn't operating and so on. The site closures
were all the social distancing.
Exactly. The more pronounced in the difficulties in building in London, you know, a tall office building in London, for example, was much, much greater impact than a civil engineering project in the middle of nowhere, which is exactly the middle of London big building, is exactly Mace's market.
Yeah.
So despite Mace being in kind of the worst market for riding out COVID, they stormed it.
Yeah, they did. They were probably all working from home because, of course, Mace, I don't think Mace actually employs a direct labour force, does it? I mean, it's entirely reliant on the subcontractors.
Yes, but they don't get their money if the subcontractors don't do the work.
No, that's true. Yeah, so that's quite interesting.
Now, who comes after Mace? I think you're about to go on to...
Well, was Waite's Group, again, but their figures for 2021, and they did increase their turnover by 12%. They turned over 1.6 billion, and they made a profit of 35.9 million on that, which is much better than the previous year, which was they only made a profit of £800,000 that year. So obviously things have improved a lot there. And then finally, number 10, it's M Group Services, which of course is Morrison, isn't it?
Parts of Morrison.
Parts of Morrison, yeah. Well, their figures are for even later. Their year ended in March 2022, March this year. Their turnover was just over 1.5 billion, and that was nearly 23% higher than the previous year.
There might be an acquisition in that. M Group Services have been quite acquisitive over the years, and there might have been an acquisition helping that along a bit.
Right, okay.
But they're becoming more and more prominent, that outfit.
Yeah, they are. Made a healthy profit, 31.3 million, and they actually made a loss the previous year. They lost £9 million a year before. So, they've got a margin, a profit margin of 2.1%, but fairly typical, maybe slightly less than average. Yeah, so that's the top 10. Funnily enough, Lange Rourke, which I'd normally expect to see in the top 10, coming at number 11 this year.
Well, there are quite a lot of big names who aren't in the top 10 that traditionally you think of as being, you know, the top 10 contractors.
Yeah.
Skanska, Vinci, Costain, Galliford Try. I mean, Galliford Try, of course, have sold off their house building business to Bovis. So they've shrunk a lot. I mean, they've still got substantial construction company, but haven't got the diversity there. Mm-hmm. And Robert McAlpine are way down at number 22, although McAlpine are a lot bigger now than they were the previous year. I mean, they had 15% turnover growth, didn't they? They're back over a billion again.
Yeah.
And they're the smallest of the £1 billion turnover club, Robert McAlpine, just over a billion, with John Graham pushing beneath them at 950 odd million. Mm-hmm. Although if you were to combine... Well, BAM Nuttall are just over a billion, BAM Constructor just below. There's an argument to say you could put the two BAM businesses together, the BAM UK businesses together. That would make them a $2 billion business up there, well, above Mace and below ISG kind of thing.
Yeah.
They'd be, you know, certainly top 10.
Yes, indeed. Again, BAM being a Dutch business, a very, very influential in the UK. I don't know how much of their work globally is in the UK and how much of it is in mainland Europe, but
it's quite significant. It's more significant to them now because they've sold off I can't remember what markets they were in, but they're in certainly Germany and I'm not sure where else, maybe Scandinavian. Over the past few years they've consolidated to the Netherlands and the UK,
yeah,
and I think there is as big in the UK as they are in the Netherlands.
Yeah, I would think they probably are.
So they're a bit like Philips or Shell. They're proper Anglo-Dutch now.
Yeah.
Well, I've been doing a little bit of looking at previous years and comparing, first of all, comparing headline figures over the past five Construction Index Top 100 analyses that we've done.
Okay.
And if you look at the bottom line, aggregate turnover of the top 100 companies that we analyse, the total turnover, add them all together, has been remarkably consistent. 2018, go back to 2018, the top 100 collectively turned over 70 billion.
Mm-hmm.
2019, 72 billion. 2020, when I say 2020, I mean that's the year we published,
looking
back. The year before.
Sure.
So 2020 republished was looking back over the year before COVID, the last year before COVID, it peaked at 75 and a half billion aggregate turnover. So from 20, so it went from 70, 72, 75 and a half. Then COVID hit and it went back to 70 and a half. And now it's 70 and a half again, a little bit, 70.6 last time, 70.4 this time, but about the same. So we've gone 70, 72, 75 and a half, 70 and a half, 70 and a half. In other words, we're back roughly where we were before pre-COVID at 75, but it had come up from that. But these are not inflation-adjusted figures, of course. 70 billion today is worth a lot less than 70 billion was even 2 years ago. So the aggregate has, in real terms, has gone down by whatever inflation has been over the past couple of years, 15% or whatever. And the other headline figure I thought would be interesting to look at, which has also been pretty steady, is the pre-tax profit margin, 2.0% average for our top 100 over the top 100 over the past year. 0.8% in our last year's issue, which included a lot of companies who had their most COVID-impacted years. Some of those results in that year would include companies who didn't have their worst COVID year. As we discussed earlier, companies like Mace and Tarmac Trading and Amy have had their worst COVID years are included in our table this year.
Yes.
But even so, the our last year table was still a positive pre-tax profit margin, 0.8. And going back pre-COVID, each year before that, 2.1, 2.7, 2.1. Mm. I suspect that 2.7 might have had a rogue number in there pushing it up. But 2.1 does seem to be the benchmark pre-tax profit margin over the past 2 years, which is the kind of margin that companies often talk about as the industry standard and what they seek to produce. Now, I also had a look at the table we produced in 2020, which predominantly included people's 2019 results, i.e. pre-COVID, to look at how companies have recovered from COVID, what their of the top ones, what their turnover and profit is now and what it was before COVID. We talked about Balfour Beatty. Comparing 2019 to 2021, Balfour Beatty is 8.4. It was. It's now 8.26, 8.3. So it's a little bit smaller. Mm-hmm. And pre-tax profit pre-COVID, 138 million. Latest pre-tax profit, 87 million. So Balfour Beatty is down a bit. If we just look at turnover, the size of it, Kia from 2019 to 2021 has gone by down from 4.5 to 3.3 billion. So that's shrunk.
Yeah.
Morgan Sindall, 3.1-ish to 3.2. That's up. And I'm just looking at the pure contractors. Galliford Try is a bit of an odd one. ISG, as I mentioned, because it sold its house building business, so ignore that. ISG, 2.6 2019. Less than 2.3, so they're down a bit, and so it goes. It's hard to find a company that's actually grown. Mace 1.8 down to 1.7. Waits is pretty steady actually. Waits 1.63. Waits is pretty steady. Wilmot Dixon 1.2. What are they now? 1.1. So there aren't many people who have sort of exploited, if you like, the pandemic and come out of it bigger and stronger. Mentioned M Group, who've had acquisitions.
Yeah,
they're now 1.26, and they were 1.17 2 years ago. So there's not, you know, that the aggregate of 72 billion that it was in. Sorry, I beg your pardon. It was 75.5 was the aggregate 2 years ago.
Yeah, in 2019.
So it was a much bigger aggregate, but that doesn't manifest itself at the top. I suppose we've had, you know, 3 billion of Interserve has disappeared.
That's true.
And re-manifested itself as Tilbury Douglas. Tilbury Douglas just scrapes into the top 50, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
372 million turnover.
It is number one. It is number 50, actually, yeah. Yeah, of course, it's a much slimmed down operation now.
Very different, yes.
I mean, I think the whole Tilbury Douglas saga is fascinating. In fact, in the same issue as the top 100, I've got an interview with the managing director of Tilbury Douglas, RMD Quickform. As was, it's now Altrad RMD Quickform, which of course was the one sort of successful bit of Interserve before everything broke up.
What did he have to say?
Well, Mark Pickard, who is the UK managing director for RMD Quickform, the reason for the interview, of course, is that RMD Quickform was the, you know, the one bright sort of beacon of stability for Interserve for many years. It was their scaffolding and formwork division, or subsidiary, I suppose. An international business. I mean, they have businesses all over the world. Well, they were acquired last October, October 2021, from Tilbury Douglas. I should rewind a bit, of course, because Tilbury Douglas is what Interserve was before it became Interserve. So that was about...
As regular listeners will be very familiar.
And, of course, Interserve went through all sorts of problems. And finally, they got rid of various bits of the business. They got out of the service side, the facilities management side of it, sold a lot of that to Mitie, actually, and then reinvented themselves as a contractor once more and reverted to the name Tilbury Douglas. So they came full circle, but they did still want to get rid of RMD Quickform. And they sold that last October to Altrad, the French group, which is itself a fascinating business because Moed Altrad, the chap who started it, is a very high profile French entrepreneur, owner of Montpellier Rugby Club and a successful novelist, started life in Syria, born into a Bedouin tribe and came over to France. He did it very well academically. He managed to get his baccalaureate age 17, came over to France on a scholarship, got himself a PhD in computer science. I mean, it's a fascinating story. Launched this business, Altrad. He bought a scaffolding firm and he's stuck with scaffolding, basically. He hasn't diversified that much, but he's been mopping up scaffolding and formwork businesses all over Europe for the last sort of 20 years or so. And one of the latest, although not the latest, was, of course, RMD Quickform, which is now Altrad RMD Quickform. Now, so Mark Pickard, the managing director, who is very loyal to Interserve, one thing he did say to me was that actually they were a good owner, Interserve. You know, they believed in us. They recognised us as an expert in our area. They invested in us. They kept our R&D programme going. So whatever else you want to say about Interserve and all its dodgy decisions over the years, it was pretty good in terms of how it dealt with RMD. They basically let them get on and do their own thing. So RMD was a very profitable business, very successful business. And Altrad tends not to buy dodgy companies. He tends to buy successful companies. And sort of absorb them into the Altrad group, but really let them continue to do their own thing. You know, they're successful going. He's not a turnaround expert. He doesn't buy ailing companies and then rebuild them and sell them on. He buys good companies and helps to make them better. So Pickard's pretty upbeat about the whole Altrad takeover. It went very smoothly. He hasn't had to make any redundancies. Altrad hasn't dictated to him how he should run the business. He's just got to, you know, he's got to stick to the budget and he's got to continue to deliver a sound performance. So anyway, yeah, Altrad, or ARMDK, they now call themselves for short.
I look forward to reading your interview with him, seeing what their plans are.
Yeah. But Tilbury Douglas, of course, which was, they've just trimmed themselves down to a contracting firm again, mainly in civil engineering. Do they do building work as well? I think they probably do, but it's mainly civils.
No, they do. They're they're on frameworks for school building and things like that. I'm sure they are.
Yes, I suppose in their previous incarnation, they were mainly civils, weren't they? But of course, Interserv got into all sorts of other activities over the years.
Well, no, I Tilbury originally was a lighterage company, sort of shipping on the River Thames.
That's right.
R.M. Douglas, yes, it's civil engineering, but and building as well, I think. Mm-hmm. Talking of buying and selling companies, there was an interesting piece I ran last week on the Construction Index website. There's a company called Alumask who make gutters, drains and roofing systems and so on. They, having a bit of a tricky time, the commercial building market has not come back as strongly as they might have hoped. And so to raise a bit of money, they sold a division for £1. A company called Levolux.
Oh, right.
Which is, Levolux make shading, solar shading systems, these fins.
Okay, yes, I know, yeah.
To keep the sun out. Yep. And they also make balconies. And it's quite a small business. Let's just have a look, see what we said about them. £8 million turnover, and they lost £2 million in the year to June this year. So in the past 12 months, lost £2 million on sales of £8
million. Yeah.
And Alumask have got rid of it, sold it for just a pound to private equity investors. Now, you were talking about turnaround merchants, people who buy up, you know, ailing companies, turn around and sell them on. Well, it's not unheard of for people to, you know, dump dogs onto into private equity companies. But Alumask clearly have got some sneaky suspicion that Levolux is worth a lot more than a pound. And I've not heard a company do this before. Maybe it's standard practice, but it seems a new one to me. They've got a sell-on clause.
Which right.
is familiar in football. When Torquay United sell a wonder kid to Southampton, a teenage prodigy to Southampton for £1 million, knowing full well that in 2 years' time, when that lad turns 20, Southampton are going to sell him on to Arsenal or Man City for 50 million.
Exactly.
That Torquay want a cut of that. You know, they want a cut of that 50 million. And so Alumask have done the same. They said to our capital partners, you can have it for a quid, but when you make it good again and sell it for, you know, much more in 3 years, 5 years' time, you owe us £1 million. So they've got the sell-on clause, which I think is smart, sensible, wise, but and imaginative, novel, I think.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of that happening before. So, I wonder how the new owners feel about that. I suppose as long as they make a profit out of it, then they'll be happy, won't they?
Yeah.
Although they'll have done all the work.
Well, they might be thinking, if I was our capital, I would kind of think, right, we've bought this entity called Levolux, and if we sell that, we owe them £1 million out of the profits back to Alumask. But what if in the intervening years, you know, we talked before about Trigger's broom with new handles and new heads, if they buy some other bit, merge it with Levolux, and sell a little bit of this, the balconies bit, and tinker with it so much that when it comes time to selling it, so, well, that's not...
Yes, that's
what
not
we're
the
selling
business.
Here is not the company that we bought from you. It's a completely different entity. I can see potential for litigation.
Yes,
there.
I was going to say, end up in the Technology and Construction Court. Yeah, interesting. I would imagine that they've had their lawyers all over it, and they've closed off as many loopholes as possible. But it's certainly an unusual situation. I've never encountered it before.
Going back to the top 100, Dave, the one point we didn't mention, which is quite interesting, is what turnover you need to qualify for the top 100. Last year, the Barhale scraped in with £160.7 million turnover. Look back to 2018, £140 million would be enough to get you in the top 50. Top 100, I think.
Top 100, right, okay.
This time, £151 million is our number 100 player, Higgins Group, an Essex contractor, just get in with £151 million turnover. Actually, they've slid down. They were £168 million time before.
Even so, yes. So the bar has risen slightly, but not by an awful lot.
Yes, in fact, there don't seem to be many new entrants. I don't know who's slipped out. I can't see who's slipped out exactly. In fact, I think Barhale might have slipped out, which would be a bit surprising.
Yeah.
But new entrants include Glencar, who are an interesting company. They've been growing steadily and strongly in the past few years, essentially building warehouse logistics, mm-hmm. big sheds. 160 million turnover for the year to September 21. And I remember writing just a couple of years ago that Glencar was on the cusp of joining the construction top 100 with its strong growth. And it's an interesting company. It is, in year to March 2019, it was only turning over 22 million. So Glencar has gone from 2019 to 2021 from 22 million to 160 million turnover.
Yeah, that's quite impressive.
Which is huge growth. And that's all on the back of these big sheds, logistics projects. It was formed by a couple of guys who used to work for McLaren Construction.
Oh, right.
Which it still is, but, you know, McLaren is very strong and dominant in
sheds,
in warehouses, big sheds, so it's kind of Glencar, sort of a not a spin-off exactly, but a breakaway from McLaren, and it's been pulling up trees in that sector, and
Well, it seems to be quite a good business to be in at the moment, doesn't it? I mean, distribution and warehousing. There are some quite significant, I suppose it's been going on for quite a few years now, but...
Well, they would be COVID winners, of course, because everyone's working from home. No one's going to the shops. Everyone's ordering stuff off the internet.
Yeah.
So we have more and more of these sheds being built for these big distribution centres.
And not just COVID, of course. I mean, the whole online shopping business has really kick-started that.
But my point about the COVID thing as well is that we talked earlier about how the type of projects which could continue working relatively normally during the pandemic and lockdowns, and these out-of-town distribution mm-hmm. centres were those sort of projects.
Yeah.
So a company like Glencar would be much less likely to have had to pull everyone off-site than someone putting up high buildings in London or city centres.
Yeah.
Last time we spoke, in our last reconstruction podcast, Dave, you promised our listeners that you were going to tell them all about who were the richest people in construction. you told us that Anthony Bamford and family was top of the list, but he's not really construction.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of proper pure builder, who is the richest?
Well, there's John Bloor I would go for the Kirkland family. The Bloors are rich and the Kirklands are rich. Let me just read this out. John Bloor, who owns the house building company that bears his name, but he also owns the Triumph motorcycle business. I mean, that's a successful business as well when you think what Triumph motorcycles used to be.
Is it? I mean, I know it's a fantastic brand and all of that, but is it profitable?
Oh, I don't know. I spoke without thinking there because actually I haven't looked at the Triumph side of things. But yeah, he owns the motorbike business. But he and his family are estimated to have wealth in excess of 2 billion. So, and that's not bad, really. It says here that Bloor benefited from a return to profit at Triumph in 2021 and a boom, obviously, in the housing market. So, yeah, Triumph was losing money. So, yeah, I take that back. If you wanted to just talk about people who are builders, if you like, just pure contracting businesses, it's the Kirkland family. So Balmer and Kirkland, of course, they're the richest contracting family. And John Kirkland, who was the head of the family and company chairman for the previous 43 years, he passed away the other year, a couple of years ago. And Jack Kirkland, his son, now heads up the business. That family now has 803 million. So edging towards a place in the top 200, the Sunday Times richest people. There's one person who you might not have heard of, who's in between John Bloor and John Kirkland. And that's a woman called Yelena Bacharina.
Did you mention her last time?
I think I might have done, because she's an interesting character. She lives in London, so she's London-based. But most of her, she's Russian-born. She's born in Moscow. most of her business is undertaken in Europe, mainly Germany. She's in the materials business. What does she make? Membranes, construction membranes. Her company's called Hitex. And she's worth an eye-watering $1.1 billion. So she qualifies simply because she's based in London. But really, she doesn't have much of an influence on the UK construction industry. But there are some other familiar names still in the sort of... I should mention, actually, that we measure the richest people in the construction industry from how they are ranked by the Sunday Times rich list, of course, which looks...
Yes, don't blame us for the utterly bogus numbers.
But I mean, we've done is to sort of go through it and find out people with an activity, and the main activity reliant on construction. Because we say that Lord Bamford and his family, who are worth sort of $4.3 billion, they're honorary members of the construction industry, if you like, because they make all the machines.
Supply,
yeah, they supply the JCB machines.
But also, it's I suspect Lord Bamford actually has got a few billion pounds to his name. But when we talk about so-and-so and family, like the late John Kirkland and family,
yeah,
it's been going for some years, Bowman Kirkland as a company, and it's unclear how many different members of the family this 800 million might be shared out. If there's eight people sharing it, okay, 100 million, yes, thank you,
yeah.
Like that. Very, very rich, but You wouldn't make the list, basically, on the Sunday Times criteria. So, by bundling a whole family's wealth into the name of one person, I mean, my brother's got a bob or two, but it doesn't let me have any of it.
Yeah, but you wouldn't figure if he was in the rich list, then you'll be out in the cold, presumably.
So best place for me.
So you wouldn't be Mr. Bishop and family. I don't know.
I would, in the words of George Best, I would spend it all on wine and women and waste the rest.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I always think of Lord Bamford as probably having most of the money in his own bank account. But of course, his other members of his family, his sons, for example, are very active. In their own right. How many sons has he got? Is it two, or is it just the one?
I'm aware of two sons and a daughter.
Yeah, yeah.
And Joe Bamford, of course, he bought the the bus.
That's right. Yeah, and he's very big into the
coach manufacturer in Northern Ireland, and big into hydrogen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And we had his chief exec, managing director of Hydrogen Company, was on Reconstruction.
He was indeed.
A year or two ago.
Yeah.
Which was an interesting chat.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, so he is obviously very wealthy, but he's a manufacturer. He's not a contractor. And so he qualifies, but only just. But we've got Steve Morgan, who's always been near the top.
Not to be confused with John Morgan. Steve Morgan of Redrow.
That's right, sorry, Redrow, yes. Not Morgan Sindel. No.
I used to risk running the wrong photo and getting them muddled up. Very different people.
There's another family who, the McCarthy family, because McCarthy and Stone, as was, a big developer of retirement homes, still is.
They've broken away now, haven't they? The sons broke away and set up
Churchill. That's right, yeah. But they're still, they're obviously doing very well for themselves. Yeah, Clinton, Spencer and John McCarthy. So those are the people we're looking at here, together worth about $662 million. One of probably the most noticeable thing is that there are fewer construction people in the Sunday Times rich list now than there have been in the past.
I'll tell you why. I think it's because they're canny. I think they, I'm not saying they hide their money from the taxmen, but they hide their business. I mean, no one knows how many, Picassos or blocks of gold bullion that Ray O'Rourke may have under his bed or in his cellar, or what the wine collection of some other big entrepreneur might be worth. There's no way of knowing. So successful people have money that you can't or wealth that you can't necessarily see.
And some people are very private. I mean, I always think
Ray
O'Rourke is one of those very private people who doesn't want people to know stuff that they don't need to know, basically. So you've got to respect him for that.
I hope I'd be the same.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, precisely. I suspect that he's absolutely mega rich, but you never know. You might have given it all away to charity. But no, there are some people who they're fairly transparent, but other people who are far more opaque when it comes to their personal wealth.
The McAlpine family used to always figure in these lists, and we don't see them anymore. I mean, there are a lot of McAlpines these days. That might have been spread a bit thin. But, I think of McAlpine as old money, perhaps unlike anyone else on this list. There might be some Gainsboroughs or Constable paintings somewhere in one of their estates somewhere, kind of thing.
Yeah, quite possibly.
Right. Any other business? Have we done that?
I think we probably have. We've been going on forever. I mean, I don't know how we managed to keep it going for so long, actually. Phil, I'm certainly running out of words. We didn't talk about Midas or NMCN.
The late lamented. They've gone.
They've gone.
They're history. Yeah. They're not news. They're history.
They're dead to us. That is true. Yeah.
Right, I think next time we meet, David, we'll be able to talk about what we think of our Prime Minister.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Well, I've already got opinions about what I think about our Prime Minister. You choose it, take your pick. we know that it's going to be one of two.
By all accounts, it's a done deal. Right.
Okay.
I'm going to wrap it up, David. I've got to go have some lunch, I think. And the sun's shining again.
Oh, lucky you. It isn't here.
Listeners, thank you once again for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast of the Construction Index. We have now done 111 of these, 111. So like umpire David Shepherd, I've spent the past hour standing on one leg. David has got no idea what I'm talking about.
No, I've got no idea at all.
To him later. But for now, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.